Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Two Westerville police officers, Eric Jeering and Anthony Morelli, were shot to death on Saturday as they responded to a call for help from the home of a known domestic abuser. Domestic violence calls are one of the most common. They are also among the most dangerous. And because every situation is different, it doesn't always get easier. Today, we're talking about those dangers and how police and others involved anticipate and prepare for that danger. Joining us is Columbus Division of Police Sergeant Richard Ketchum, who is a member of the city's domestic violence unit. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Domestic violence calls are dangerous. They can turn deadly, as we saw tragically over the weekend. Why are they so innately dangerous? What is it about them?
I think you first have to look at the fact that we're talking about family violence in and of itself. When an individual escalates to, you know, family violence in and of itself, and now law enforcement is summoned to respond, and we're basically interjecting ourselves into their home, their household, their life, and most folks are not real keen on us becoming part of their personal issues or their home issues.
I read something that if somebody's going to hurt the people they consider closest to them and the people they love the most, they won't think twice about hurting a police officer. But that still surprised me because you just think of that it's the police, it's the authority.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. To begin assaulting or commit an act of violence against someone that you love or that you care about, again, you bring a government entity, the law enforcement, into the home or into their household, and you know most people believe they can handle these issues themselves, and when they will escalate to a level of violence with a loved one. Most outside entities obviously are not going to be near as important to them as the person that they, for lack of better terms, are trying to control.
Where's the point? Is it with what happened on Saturday in Westerville? Was that a classic situation that entering the home, entering the apartment or the townhouse or wherever it was and having to face them for the first time, is that considered the most dangerous part?
You know, there's several different things that I would technically consider dangerous. Again, I don't have all of the facts of everything
that
took
place. Yeah.
In general, you know, there are times when we are dispatched on a call where we have a sufficient amount of information to know in somewhat good detail what we're responding to. We may have particulars that this is a domestic violence situation. We may know the name of the offender. Maybe the officers responding are familiar with these parties and have some history with them. On the flip side of that, a 911 hang-up call. If that's the only information we know, and sometimes that is all that we have when we're responding to a call, a 911 hang-up call could be something such as a medical emergency that we find out once we get there, or worst case scenario, it could end up in a situation that took place Saturday.
What kind of clues do you look for with a hang-up call? Is there anything?
The only clues, honestly, you're going to be able to look for are whether or not you have personally responded to that residence before. Maybe you're familiar with the parties that live there. Outside of that, the only other information you're going to get is ultimately what is provided, if at all, to the dispatcher, and that they're able to relay to you while you're en route to that location.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're taking a look back to consider the circumstances, not specifically of the case of the two Westerville police officers who were shot and killed over the weekend as they responded to a call from help. But in general, when it comes to domestic violence situations or suspected situations that might involve domestic violence, what can we do, and how do police train to respond to these calls? My guest right now, Sergeant Richard Ketchum. He's part of the Domestic Violence Unit of the Columbus Division of Police. Coming up, we're going to hear from people who deal with domestic violence victims and how they manage that. Also at the city attorney's office, how they work with these kinds of cases. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, we were talking earlier and you said that there has been an uptick in the cases that your unit takes now, and that has to do with changes in training. How so?
That's correct. In 2017, our unit, the domestic violence unit, there are 10 detectives in the unit as well as myself. And we had been educating ourselves up until that point on the topic of strangulation. In March of 2017, we attended a two-day training class with folks from the National Institute on Strangulation Prevention. They came here to Columbus, Ohio. As a result of that training, we knew we were already recognizing this crime as being something very significant. Following that training, it seems as though the floodgates opened, and I do believe it's simply because we are recognizing it now.
Can you give me an example of what you mean by that? What are you seeing?
Strangulation seems to be more and more common in a lot of the domestic violence cases. It is the ultimate form of power and control. It's literally the life of the victim in the hands of the abuser. So what we have done is we have better educated ourselves on signs, symptoms, and those types of things in regards to strangulation, and some of the things we now look for in order to actually proceed with a case as a felony as opposed to filing a misdemeanor domestic violence and assault charge.
There have been, and this popped up again in this case, but, you know, we can't really talk about it because we don't really know all the issues. But why people who have filed protection orders against abusers change them, drop them, ask for them to come home, protect them in a way? Why does that happen? What do we understand about that dynamic?
Well, when it comes to protection orders, it is something that we definitely encourage victims to seek. But you also have to understand there's what we call the cycle of violence. So a violent act occurs. Maybe the perpetrator is arrested in that scenario, and then the circle starts to work its way around. And what we often refer to it is the honeymoon phase. There's apologies, there's makeups. I promise this will never happen again. And there's that eventual building. And then that is some of the reasoning behind why protection orders get dropped or they're asked to be dismissed. And then the makeup phase. And then unfortunately, way too often, as a matter of fact, we see a repeat act of violence somewhere down the road.
If somebody is a known abuser, there have been calls to this residence before, just hypothetically. How does that change the approach to, responding to a 911 call?
Well, I think from an officer's perspective, again, if it's multiple times that they've been to that home, maybe they've made arrests there on the perpetrator. From an educational side of things, they are much more aware of the volatility potentially of that situation, the parties involved. Maybe there's been a previous incident where officers have been engaged in a physical altercation with the suspect when they've went to arrest them. So knowing all those things ahead of time, if it's possible, are very beneficial because, again, you're going to mentally prepare, not that you don't for every run, but it's going to potentially mentally prepare you differently or maybe even at a higher level because you're already anticipating something at least like that happening again or maybe much worse.
Do officers always work in pairs when it comes to domestic violence cases?
The Columbus Division of Police, our dispatching system, it is a two-officer call.
Anyway.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So when a domestic violence call comes in, it's required that they dispatch at least two officers to that call.
And how are they trained to handle those kinds of things? Let's say they get in and they survive the moment. How are they trained to handle it? What goes into that?
Well, typically, let me start from the very beginning.
Sure.
In the police academy, our recruits actually go through two entire days of training specific to domestic violence protection orders, stalking, strangulation, to cover all aspects of intimate partner violence. There's also role-playing scenarios and report writing and other things like that that they go through in the academy. Then when they come out on the street, they're with their coaches, multiple coaches over an extended period of time. So they're exposed to these types of calls. Bottom line is when we are called to a call of domestic violence, we are looking to establish contact with both parties, conduct interviews with both parties. We want the parties separated to where obviously they cannot hear one another, but on from an officer safety standpoint, we're obviously keeping an eye on one another. So we're still in close proximity, but not close enough to where both parties can hear.
But you guys can see each other.
Absolutely. Okay. And then we're looking on whether or not we have probable cause to make an arrest. So we're looking for the elements of assault, the elements of a family or household member that would constitute domestic violence. And if those things are present and we establish probable cause, then the preferred course of action is arrest.
You know, I read recently that women are just as likely to be perpetrators in these cases. And I found that kind of hard to believe. But tell me about what the incidence is and how you have to keep an open mind when you're entering one of these disputes.
You definitely have to keep an open mind. I would say statistically from our perspective, we see more male perpetrators than female perpetrators, but we absolutely see both. The other thing you have to take into consideration when you're putting together an investigation and you're conducting interviews is, you know, is the response by one of the parties potentially self-defense? So, you know, those are things have to take into consideration.
The scratches on the face. Well, that was hurt. Yeah. Okay. Gotcha.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We have to take those things into consideration when we're trying to determine who our primary physical aggressor is. That is the ultimate goal, is to determine who the primary aggressor is. And that is the person that we're looking in, obviously, to file charges on and or make the arrest.
And so you make an arrest. You take the person away. The people that are left behind, how do you counsel them? What do you direct them to do? What's next for them?
Well, obviously, the officers spend a fair amount of time at the scene with the victim. You know, we hope, obviously, that there's good dialogue between the two. We try to offer resources to them. One thing we did as a division of police, along with approximately 19 other agencies in Franklin County, is in April of 2015, or May of 2015, I believe it was, we implemented the Lethality Assessment Program. Basically, what that is, short version, an officer responds to a domestic violence situation. Maybe they are making an arrest or filing charges on an offender. They then sit down with the victim and they go through an 11-question screening tool with them. That tool basically is to gauge the level of danger within that relationship. Depending on the answers to the questions that are provided by the victim, it determines whether or not that person screens in what we call high danger or non-high danger.
Can you give me an example of one of those questions that is a red flag?
Sure. Has he or she ever threatened to kill you? Does he or she have access to weapons? Has he or she ever choked you? And that's just three of the 11. If a victim screens in high danger, the protocol at that point is the officer will get on the phone with the hotline. The hotline is run through Choices, and we attempt at that point to put the victim in touch with services right then and there from the scene.
And by the way, we'll be hearing from the executive director of Choices for Victims of Domestic Violence. That's a group that has response to with a hotline and also houses men, women, and children impacted by domestic violence. Where does the role, how does the issue of children and pets come into play in these kinds of cases?
Well, let's start with pets. We do see that from time to time, and that's a challenge for some. As many of us know, many of us have pets. That is at times an obstacle for a person choosing to actually leave the safety of their home.
They can't take the pet with them?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There are some programs or a program that I'm aware of in place to where, depending on the time of the day this takes place, we can assist them in seeking shelter for their pet, at least temporarily, while they have the opportunity to take the next steps in order to render themselves safe. I'll allow Sue, when she gets here, to talk a little bit further about the new shelter that's coming down the road, because I think that's going to address some of those issues as well.
But abuse of pets is often a sign.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When we see that, it throws up a red flag for us.
What about children? How are they handled in these kind of cases? What happens to them?
Unfortunately, children are exposed to this. And I, this won't be an exact number, but the statistics are somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 in 400 is the number if a child grows up in a home where they do not experience or see or are exposed to violence, 1 in 400 chance of becoming a victim or a perpetrator of violence. That number drops exponentially to 1 in 2 for a child who grows up in a home that is constantly exposed to or victim of violence, of them becoming a perpetrator or a victim later on in life. So it's important that we do what we can to assist these children in these scenarios, get them the help they need. There are referrals to children's services that are made, among other things.
Do you ever find it that the primary victim, the spouse, the partner, is not able to separate for whatever reason and the children have to be taken out of the situation? I mean, is that...
It does happen. I wouldn't say that I necessarily see that on a regular basis.
Okay.
But, a lot of the investigations that are done by Children's Services, my unit, and we are not necessarily privileged to.
Okay.
So I wouldn't necessarily know the answer to that on a regular basis.
Sergeant Ketchum, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much.
That's Sergeant Richard Ketchum. He's part of the Domestic Violence Unit of the Columbus Division of Police. Coming up, we're going to hear from the director of the Domestic Violence and Stalking Unit at the Columbus City Attorney's Office, and also the executive director of Choices for Victims of Domestic Violence right here in Central Ohio. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about domestic violence, how too often the threat extends beyond an immediate household and tragically to first responders and others. The most recent reminder, the shooting deaths of two veteran Westerville police officers on Saturday as they responded to a suspected domestic violence case. Joining us is Executive Director of Choices for Victims of Domestic Violence, Sue Valillo. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Also, Director of the Domestic Violence and Stalking Unit at the Columbus City Attorney's Office, Ann Murray. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
What is the probability of a domestic violence case being brought before a jury? How many of them actually ever get to that point?
Statistically, very few actually go to jury for a number of reasons. I would say that about half of the victims are not cooperative because they don't want that resolution to the case. They want the violence to stop maybe, but there's a whole lot of other things going on in their life, and so prosecution's not the first thing that they have to deal with. If it's a very, very strong case, that case, the person may plead right away. If it's a very weak case, we may have to make a plea bargain. So that means it's the kind of medium cases that are the ones that actually go to trial.
Is there any sense about taking these things to trial without cooperation from the victims?
There
is that
are,
increasing? Is that
it
what's,
is?
What's the state of affairs on that?
Yeah, thank you. It is really difficult because of the rules of evidence, because of the right to confrontation. So, unfortunately, a lot of the onus rests on the victim's shoulders, and that makes it so hard. We know statistically that the minute that an incident happens, there's a target on a victim's back to try to get that victim to not cooperate, and that can be done through sugar or vinegar. So one of the things I know that I heard Rick talk earlier about dropping protection orders, it can be from lack of service, it can be from threats, it can be from stalking, it can be all sorts of things that cause a victim to not cooperate in a prosecution or to not continue with the protection.
And does the pressure come to bear just from the perpetrator, or are there others that weigh in on the in these kind of things?
Generally, it is systemic. It will be we see a lot of stalking by proxy, so defendants' families, defendants, but it also could be the victims, right? We know that there's a very strong sense of, I want to keep my family together. I want my child to have a father if it is a male perpetrator. I or I just can't deal with the prosecution. I've got to go to my job. I've got to get my kids back. I've got to figure out where I'm going to live now. And stalking is a huge, huge issue.
And Sue Villillo, the idea of I want to keep my family together, in a way, that's where you come in as far as keeping what you can of a family together.
It is, and that's why people often come into shelter when they are seeking someplace safe to stay with their family away from the abuser if they're not arrested as the result of the incident.
How has the idea of shelter changed over the last 20 or 30 years?
In a couple of ways. First and foremost is that we acknowledge that there are male and female victims of domestic violence, and shelters are now open to male victims and their children as well as female victims. I think the other thing that's really changed in sheltering is that now we know shelters can be found by the abuser. So in the past, there was kind of this feeling of secrecy and we could hide people. And we know in this day and age that we can't hide people anymore. So we've really changed how we address security and safety, both inside and outside of the shelter.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You know, in the wake of the tragic shootings of the Westerville police officers who are responding to a domestic violence situation in Westerville, we decided to talk about domestic violence today and see what the score is when it comes to law enforcement, how they're trained to deal with it from the point of view of the Columbus City Attorney's Office and the Domestic Violence and Stalking Unit there, and also from the point of view of Choices for Victims of Domestic Violence. That's a place that shelters and helps men, women, and children affected by domestic violence. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you want to know how the system works, if you're affected by domestic violence, these are two people that would be great to ask questions of. They know what they're talking about. Sue Villillo is Executive Director of Choices for Victims of Domestic Violence, and also Anne Murray is Director of the Domestic Violence and Stalking Unit at the Columbus City Attorney's Office. Let's talk about why a domestic violence victim chooses not to press charges at all. Sue Villillo, how much of that is present in the conversations you're having with the people that you serve?
Very frequently. And the range of reasons from fear to, as Annie said, wanting to keep a family together to the difficulty in getting through the process, all of those are reasons that victims may not participate in the criminal phase of this.
What's the difficulty in going through a process like that?
It's time consuming. It's very emotional. Folks need to work. They need to be, as Annie said, looking for housing. They have other priorities. And if you're spending hours at court, that distracts from all of those other things that you need to be taking care of as well.
How often do you find people have sort of come to a impasse in their life? They're just sort of learning to live with it and they think they're going to survive this?
We probably don't see a whole lot of those.
Because they're seeking help.
Because they're seeking help from us, yes.
Okay. But Anne Marie, what about you? Don't people who say, you know what, I can handle this, don't worry about it, I've lived this long, I'll survive more longer?
I think I wanted to kind of piggyback on what Sue was saying about those who seek services or those who do not. One of the things that the studies show is that those who have advocacy the soonest after an incident happened are better able to go forward with prosecution. So one of the things that we rely on Choices for, and we also have a staff of advocates, to really try to support the victims going through who do have charges filed, to try to help them with all the other barriers. So all the things that Sue talked about.
The red tape, all the rigmarole.
And Children's Services is happening. And, you know, what is your big issue? So because a lot of the times it's not I want to prosecute. It's I need transportation. I need to get to my job. I need to do all those things. So I do think, and the studies also show that victims rarely overestimate their danger. They will sometimes underestimate their danger. So that's Dr. Jacqueline Campbell is the one who has done extensive research on lethality with domestic violence. And so part of this lethality assessment program that Choices and several police agencies in Columbus are doing deal with that whole idea of does the victim, one of the questions is, does the victim feel that this person could kill them? And the lethality screen honors that. So then they hook them up with the hotline immediately if the victim wants to speak to the hotline.
When I was talking about what police do, how much has that changed, in your opinion, over the years? I mean, it's really just been maybe 25 years since the Ohio General Assembly was really giving this a good look back in the day.
Right. It's changed exponentially.
Yeah.
A colleague and I have been training Columbus police for decades. I'm dating myself.
There's always another group coming in, right?
Yeah. But what's really remarkable is in the beginning we had to explain what domestic violence was and what the dynamics were, and now the recruits know. So we can skip right into, okay, let's talk about, you know, the what might a scene look like? What does trauma look like in terms of a victim being able to express to you? What are the lethality factors? Those types of things. We can dive right in.
And when you say that recruits already know, is that because they're now getting trained in the academy?
Oh, we're the ones that are training them in the academy. Yeah.
Okay.
No, I think that as a society, right. I think that it's better known because of the work that organizations like Choices and many other organizations have done. So what's great about that is now we don't have to take time explaining that. We dive right into, okay, how do we help this? And one of the things that we do when we are training police recruits is we try to say, look, we need to assume that the victim may not want to help ultimately with this case. So build the case as if the victim will not. And then if the victim is there, that completely supports them. So with all of the documentation, the other thing that we do is we really try to talk about trauma. We've learned a lot about what trauma does to the brain.
Uh-huh.
And how can somebody ask questions in a way that will get the best answer and also help the victim not blame themselves because I don't remember or I don't know why I did this. I don't know why I ran out or those types of things. So we are able to get into all sorts of different issues. I know Rick talked about strangulation. We're learning more and more about how dangerous that is. We're training law enforcement about that. Look for that. How do you investigate that? How do you get that information to prosecutors so we can then handle the case in the best way possible?
Sue Villillo, when the people you serve, what do they say about the impact of law enforcement and their contact with them? How does it make a difference?
I will say, especially since the implementation of the LAP program, we have just seen a huge difference in how victims respond to us about the police, and that it's been overwhelmingly favorable. And I know as somebody who's taken hotline calls myself when the officer is called in, you can hear the concern from the officer's point of view. And they've
already done that 15 or 11 question assessment.
They've done the 11 question assessment. Yeah. They're calling now to link the person with the hotline. And you can hear them. You can hear how they interact with the victim. And you can hear the support and encouragement that they are giving them. And that seems pretty consistent, truthfully, over the last 2 years as we've implemented the LAP program.
You're getting a new facility.
Yes.
How's that going?
It's going well. We have actually broken ground. We are hoping to be in by the end of this calendar year. We currently operate a 51-bed shelter. I will tell you that last night we had 84 people in that building. We have 22 households on a wait list, so the new building can't get here fast enough. We will have 120 beds in the new facility and believe that we will be able to meet the demand that really exists in this community for safe shelter.
What is the role of the sheltering system, Anne Marie, in what you do? I mean, how does that help your job, knowing that there's a good shelter out there?
It's huge. What's so important is, again, kind of that idea of what are the barriers to someone being able to prosecute a case. If they're worrying about a safe place to stay or the intimidation from their abuser, that they're simply not going to be able to come and handle the whole prosecution, which could be a lengthy process. So we actually house, through a grant, a staff member from Choices to kind of liaise with our office when a victim is in need of immediate shelter or any of the other services that Choices offers. It's so helpful.
It kind of, there's a calming effect, settling.
Yeah, at least on our part, and the staff, because I think that that's one of the things that's so fantastic about the LAP program, the Lethality Assessment Program, is officers do their job and they do it very well generally. But they're not advocates, right? They're not experts in domestic violence. So having that hotline on the phone to pass the ball to help the victim to safety is huge. That's one of the things that I hear from law enforcement. And so that's also how we feel as prosecutors or advocates in the system. Victims may not want to go through the criminal system, so it's hugely helpful to have another outside agency that can help them through other needs, counseling needs or housing or other transportation. They've got case managers. So we feel hugely grateful for having Choices work with us.
So a police officer has done the lethality
screen.
The screen, mm-hmm. The 11-question screen. They've determined that there is danger. They get the victim on the phone, on the hotline to you. Then what happens?
Then we have about 10 minutes to work through an immediate safety plan with the victim. So what can we do right now to keep you safe? So if the perpetrator is arrested, there's sort of a different scenario. If the perpetrator is not arrested, then we're talking about, do you need shelter? Do you have someplace safe to go? How can we help get you there?
It seems to me that as soon as they're taken away and there's that immediate sense of safety, there's also a lot of chance to start regretting, to start second guessing yourself. Who's there to support them during that? Kind of what I would think of as a pretty critical period of time.
I think that's really the value of the hotline call from the police officer, because we have that opportunity to immediately intervene and talk to the victim about what has occurred. Kind of normalize their feelings about the situation, certainly not normalize the situation, but help them to understand what's happening. And when someone does leave and they're there alone, we have given them other things to think about besides feeling guilt or shame.
I also want to say that we have a staff of advocates, and I want to give a shout out to the hard work that they do every day.
Uh-huh.
We contact the victims the minute that we get a case. So if charges are filed, our advocates are on it, and they are highly trained in all. I don't want to make it sound as if we only have the Choices advocate. So they are trained in resources in the community, in trauma-informed care, in all of those things, and they walk with that victim from the first court date all the way through the end of the case, should the victim choose to come. They also are on the phone with them and answering questions about what's this going to be like? What am I going to go through? Am I going to, you know, what if I want to say this? What if I want to, you know, go forward? What if I don't want to say that I want to go forward? All of those things.
Yeah.
So we have an advocate in every courtroom, particularly in that initial stage. So what's great is the lethality screen is getting the victims hooked up with Choices, but we are also trying to kind of work in tandem with them to make sure that if they are participating with us, that we are getting information to them to resolve the barriers in their lives and help them plan for their safety.
We're going to continue our conversation. You just heard from Ann Murray. She's director of the Domestic Violence and Stalking Unit at the Columbus City Attorney's Office. Also with us, Sue Valillo. She's executive director of Choices for Victims of Domestic Violence. That's a group that helps house men, women, and children affected by domestic violence. And also pets. We'll hear more about that coming up. Their new facility has options for pets as well. So if you have a question or comment about any of this, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the challenges domestic violence poses for survivors, advocates, and police. Of the 64 firearms-related killings of police in 2016, domestic disputes topped the list of circumstances ending in an officer's death. That's according to a report by the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund, and it's a fact tragically underscored in the shooting deaths of two veteran Westerville police officers on Saturday. Still with us is director of the Domestic Violence and Stalking Unit at the Columbus City Attorney's Office, Ann Murray. Also, executive director of Choices for Victims of Domestic Violence, Sue Valillo. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513. A victim doesn't want to press charges but needs protection. What's the role of your office in that case, Ann Murray?
The big thing that we do and that our advocates do is try to not just say, okay, that's the end and we'll dismiss the charges, because there's so many reasons why a victim may not want to go through the criminal system. One, it's just a terrible thing to have to go through. I think none of us would ever choose to go through that system. But so what we try to do is figure out why. What's going on? Is it that because I'm being threatened? Is it because I'm very hopeful that there have been conversations that I'm going to get counseling and I'm going to change? Is it that I can't come because of my job and I'm afraid I'm going to lose my job and I can't afford to lose my job? There's so many things. So what we try to do is figure out, working with them, hey, what's going on? And then try to the best of our ability, address that so that we can then get to. And one of the things that we find is a lot of victims will assume, oh, this means they're going to jail. And there's so many other options besides jail that our courts willingly offer.
Like what?
There's counseling. There's a lot of times there'll be substance abuse counseling if there's a substance abuse issue. And while that does not cause domestic violence, it's an accelerant. So yeah. Our probation department is really strong in terms of working with individuals to try to get at, hey, what is the root cause of what's going on? And one of the things that they tell us is they're doing a full assessment. So if it is simply an aberrant incident, then that's how they're going to treat it. But if this is an underlying abuse controlling issue, then they're going to deal with it that way.
What do we know about the underlying causes of domestic violence? I read that, or I should I take that back. The guest from the domestic violence unit in the Division of Police said that 1 in 600 people will be a perpetrator who have never been affected by domestic violence themselves. And among those who have been affected by it, it's 1 out of 2 will be a perpetrator in the future. But what is at the root of it? Do we know? You guys look at each other and sort of like, is that the $6 million question?
I was just going to say it's generally a learned behavior, right? And you think about it, if you have children, how do you parent? Do you parent – there's something my dad did that I really disliked when I was a kid. And when I had my children, I noticed that I was like, take 2 minutes. And I hated that. But it was a reflex. So I think that part of that is what happens, that if that's what we know, that may be what we expect and what we reflexively do. The other thing is, one of the things that we see with abusers is the overwhelming need to control. So it may not result in physical violence if I can control all of your behaviors in other ways. And that's one of the things that they say is even the most lethal, this needing to control absolutely every element of their own as well as their partners' and children's lives.
Anne from Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Anne.
Yes.
You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about there's help for the victims, but how do we stop this? How do we help the perpetrators to eventually overcome this? They just talked about the control issue, but are there programs for the perpetrators?
Yeah. What do we know about the effectiveness as well?
There are programs for batters. That's a great question. And one of the things that our probation department does is try to hook them up with programs that deal with the issues that they have. Again, if it's not at a root cause of the violence, then they're not going to have to go through batterer intervention programs. But they're really going to get at what are the ways that the individual is seeing the violence. And most of the time what they're doing is they're seeing violence as reasonable, rational, and justified, when in fact they're not taking into consideration the partner's or the child's feelings and behaviors. So that's what the batter intervention programs will do. One of the things that we know is the individual has to really want to change to be able to do it, because what I tell victims is, look, there may be 24 years or 36 years of learning how to do this. It's not going to go way overnight. So the batter intervention is going to be something where it's going to be long term. It's not going to be done in a few weeks. And it really is changing a perspective on life.
Thanks a lot, Ann, for that call. Appreciate it. 614-292-8513 for others out there. Sergeant Ketchum of the Domestic Violence Unit of the Columbus Division of Police said that they're not necessarily privy to what happens to children in these cases. And I'm wondering about what happens to children in the cases of where the primary victim, the parent, one of the parents, doesn't want to press charges, doesn't want to go through with it. How is the child protected when there's a known abuser?
Do you want me to take that?
Yeah, Anne Marie.
One of the things that we see, Anne, is it's a real pickle for victims who are in domestic violence situations. When victims have left, that's the most dangerous time, right? So
yeah.
They may want to get their children away. If there is a custody battle, sometimes the abusers are the more powerful in terms of finances or whatnot. That can be really hard. There's an assumption as well that there will be joint parenting. So if there is an abuser and I am in the home with the abuser, I can control as a victim. I could potentially control the abuser's access to that child or at least see what's going on and maybe feel that I can manage that. If the abuser gets half time alone with the child, I may not be sure and may feel that I cannot protect them. One of the things that we know is that when victims do prove domestic violence in domestic relations courts, that they're not – they get supervised visitation only for a little bit of time and then they'll normalize it to shared parenting. So again, that problem is always there. Children's Services works hard to try to make sure that they are protecting the children as well as trying to make sure they are cognizant of the fact if a victim is in a violent relationship and trying to do the best that they can. So that's one of the things that they've been working on is trying not to take the kids if this situation is going on. The victim is simply trying to keep everybody safe. And they're going to get classes for the victim as well as the abuser in those situations and try to keep the victim with her children.
John, you're on the air.
Hi. Hi. I'm calling to ask, I want to know, in the cases that you're talking about, how often do we actually see a rehabilitation of the abuser instead of just this continuation of a pattern of abuse?
That's a great question. One of the things is because I'm a prosecutor, if there is actual rehabilitation, then I'm not going to see those parties again. What I do know is that recidivism tends to be fairly high. Again, the person has to want to change. They have to really buy into it for it to be successful. And so what I've heard is statistically it's not very high. But those that do, there is a chance.
Thanks, John. Suvalillo, what's it like at Choices?
Well, it's busy, for one thing. As I said,
you're still in your old facility.
We're still in the old facility. Mm-hmm. So a little bit overcrowded. It's filled, though, with activities that are to benefit the folks that are staying there. So we offer case management services to help people kind of create their own goals and work toward them. We have a crisis clinician that can work with people, especially as they come into shelter, really help through work through the trauma of the event. We offer support groups and education groups inside the shelter. And then we do lots of things that you would do at home. Tomorrow we're having a Valentine's party. We try to have birthday parties for all the kids. We want to normalize life as much as possible. We do have an awful lot of kids, 46, I believe, in the building today. And we want to build resilience for those children, and we want to help the parents learn how to do it once they've left the shelter. So focus heavily on a lot of fun, nurturing activities, both for the parents and the children.
And there is a role, the whole pet thing is a big issue, and your new facility is going to have pets allowed?
We will have a kennel on site. We have a fantastic partnership with the Columbus Area Humane Society. And they actually right now will take pets of folks that are staying in our shelter, and they will assist us with the new kennel on the shelter premises when we get moved.
How big of a deal is that?
I'm not sure that we know, because right now we can't take pets, so I don't think we know exactly what the need is. I think we'll get a better idea once we're able to actually do that.
But you know that people are worried about their pets.
We know that people are worried about their pets. We know sometimes people won't come into shelter who would otherwise want shelter. I will say that in addition to shelter, we offer a community advocacy program that works with victims in the community, whether they stay in their home or continue in the relationship or they've moved. We can work with them in the community to help them access resources and maintain their safety. So we do offer some services to folks that are living in the community, not just folks in shelter.
And is it just people who have children or all different kinds?
Yeah, any household that considers themselves a family. So single adults, adults with children, we've had multi-generational families because that's who the family was that needed to flee the violence.
And what's the dynamic been like now that you permit male victims in the shelter?
You know, it was very interesting to watch that happen. It was a much larger issue for the staff to come to terms with than it was for the residents. Residents really recognized male or female in each other very quickly that they were in the same situation.
And why was it difficult for the staff? Just because they're used to dealing with mostly
because
women?
Because they were so used to dealing with women. And there was this kind of long-held belief that men shouldn't come into shelter or that a male in shelter may actually be a secret abuser. And what we found very quickly, immediately, was that wasn't the case, that the male victims were in the same exact situation as the female victims.
Is it the same when you're working with male victims as it is with female victims when it comes to prosecuting, pressing charges, that kind of a thing? Is it pretty much the same thing or how might it differ, Anne Marie?
Certainly, we're going to try to treat someone where they are. And we do see that about 85% of our victims are female and only the rest are male. Mm-hmm. And some of those are children, the male victims. So we know that it can be shameful for a man to come forward. We train very hard with law enforcement to kind of anticipate that, to say if a man is going to call and ask for help, please respect the fact that this could be very hard given our society and the fact that men are supposed to be strong, right? That's the message, and that they may be embarrassed if they're trying to tell you. So we try to train respect at all levels. We do it with prosecutors as well. We do try to treat them. You know, Choices does take men. We're going to refer them there. The probation department is going to offer services. We're going to offer advocacy services. So to the best of our ability, we do. But there are fewer cases. The other thing I will say is the studies show there are absolutely male victims. There are female perpetrators. One question that they ask is, when there is violence, did the victim experience fear? And one of the things that they said is when they were talking to men and women, that fewer men experienced fear when there was violence from their partner as opposed to women.
Okay, interesting. And the new location, it's going to be undisclosed. It's going to be mm-hmm. secret, just like the current one is. But you mentioned earlier, Sue Villillo, that given the nature of the technology today, it's hard to keep it completely secret. How do you do
Correct.
That? I mean, what's the process? How do you keep people from finding out?
Well, we can't, is the bottom line. So we never share the address. So we don't do anything to perpetuate or make
right.
it easy to find. But we know people can find us. So instead of assuming that we can't be found, we know that we can be found, and we have security strategies around that. So we protect the facility and the people in it knowing that we can be found.
Is it hidden in the middle of everything? Or is it
to some
isolated?
Extent, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you have to be somewhat centrally located?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Folks have to be able to get on with their lives while they're living in shelter.
And how does the Choices help people carry on with their normal lives? Do kids still go to school? Do they still go to work? How do you help them do that?
Children do still go to school. They can either go to the school that they were attending previously, if it was within Franklin County, or they can go to the school in the neighborhood, and that is the parent's choice, what's safest and best for the family. We can help make transportation arrangements. We can help with childcare if a parent is working. So we want the family to continue with as many of their activities as possible, and we help them safety plan around how to do all of those activities in a way that will keep them safe.
How many people work at Choices?
Oh, it varies. Probably close to half, at least by the time they're exiting shelter.
I think I read that in the mornings when the door is shut to your office, you knock first because
that is true.
There might be somebody staying there.
Do need to use offices as bedrooms sometimes, and we're just prepared to do that. We want people to have a place to come that's safe, and that has to be our first priority.
I guess this is probably never going to go away.
I'd like to disagree with you, but I don't think I can.
I would agree, unfortunately. Okay. What I do think is that it's important, and one of the things that we're noticing is that the community is huge. So the criminal justice system is just one portion. Choices is able to do what Choices is able to do, but somebody in the community recognizing the signs, mm-hmm. someone knowing where to refer somebody, and actually just trying to help the isolation that a lot of victims feel, that can truly combat somebody who's in an abusive relationship and help them plan for their safety.
Anne Murray, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Anne Murray's director of the Domestic Violence and Stalking Unit at the Columbus City Attorney's Office, and Sue Valillo of Choices for Victims of Domestic Violence, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Sue Valillo is executive director of Choices for Victims of Domestic Violence. That's a group that helps house men, women, and children impacted by domestic violence in Central Ohio. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.